Hello, this is Mark Grier, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the September 18th issue of the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Okay, first article, who is Brendan Carr of the FCC? The chairman of the FCC, who is in the spotlight for his comments that may have led to the suspension of late-night TV host Jimmy Kimmel, has long criticized the media for perceived bias. Brendan Carr, the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, which is the nation's top watchdog over the broadcast industry, was at the center of media storm on Wednesday. In an interview on a right-wing podcast, Mr. Carr criticized comments that late-night host Jimmy Kimmel had made earlier this week about the killing of conservative activist Charlie Kirk. Shortly afterward, ABC decided to pull the Jimmy Kimmel live show off the air indefinitely. Many Democrats immediately criticized the FCC pressure, while President Trump said the suspension of Mr. Kimmel's show was great news for America. Here's what to know about Mr. Carr. What is Carr's background? Mr. Carr, 46, a native of Washington, D.C., began his career as a lawyer representing corporate clients, including in the wireless industry, on regulatory matters. In 2012, he joined the FCC as a staff attorney. Since then, he has risen the ranks at the agency and within the Republican Party. He worked with Mr. Trump's first-term pick for the regulatory chair. In mid-2017, Mr. Carr was named to a Republican seat on the commission. As a commissioner, he drew attention from Republicans for his vocal criticism of news media outlets for what he called liberal biases. Mr. Carr wrote the FCC chapter for Project 2025, a playbook written for Mr. Trump's 2024 campaign and election. In it, Mr. Carr said the agency should focus on reining in big tech firms, which he accused of censorship. The FCC should promote freedom of speech, he wrote in the first words in the chapter. Why did President Trump pick Carr to chair the FCC? In many ways, Mr. Carr was the obvious choice. He had more experience in communications regulation than nearly any other candidate and was well known in the policy world. In frequent appearances on Fox News and in prolific social media postings, Mr. Carr echoed Mr. Trump's growing anger toward broadcasters during the election. Mr. Carr was also well connected within conservative Washington organizations like the Heritage Foundation and the Federalist Society. Before the election, Mr. Carr hitched his star to Elon Musk, then a confidant of Mr. Trump. On X, the social media platform owned by Mr. Musk, Mr. Carr posted photos of himself at SpaceX launches and other business ventures run by the billionaire. Commissioner Carr is a warrior for freedom of speech and has fought against the regulatory lawfare that has stifled America's freedoms and held back our economy, Mr. Trump said when he named Mr. Carr the head of the FCC in January. What has Carr done since taking over the FCC? Well, Mr. Carr quickly launched investigations into diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, pushing to dismantle them, then slashed regulations on broadband companies. In January, he reinstated complaints against CBS, NBC, and ABC that accused the broadcasters of political biases. The FCC, under former President Joe Biden, had dismissed the complaints, saying they violated the First Amendment. In March, Mr. Carr started investigating ABC for its diversity policies, something he said he would scrutinize for discriminatory practices. In April, he accused Comcast, who owns NBC, of news distortion. excuse me, in a complaint filed to the FCC in October 2024 against CBS's 60 Minutes, a conservative group accused the network of editing an interview with former Vice President Kamala Harris to make her look good. Mr. Carr went on to link the CBS complaint to its parent company Paramount's $8 billion deal to merge with Skydance, which was under review at the FCC for approval. In early July, Paramount settled Mr. Trump's lawsuit against CBS for $16 million. Weeks later, Mr. Carr approved the Paramount-Skydance merger. How can Carr punish the media? Mr. Carr's power lies with the licenses that the FCC doles out to radio and TV stations to broadcast over public airwaves. While the FCC cannot directly ban a news network for its content, Mr. Carr has argued that he can withhold licenses that aren't being used in the public's interest. The public interest standard can be broadly defined, and many telecom experts say that more than any other FCC chair, Mr. Carr has used his position to crack down on speech he finds offensive. What did Carr say about Jimmy Kimmel? During his opening monologue on Monday, Mr. Kimmel addressed the killing of Mr. Kirk by saying, "We hit some new lows over the weekend with the MAGA gang desperately trying to characterize this kid who murdered Charlie Kirk as anything other than one of them, and doing everything they can to score political points from it." In the podcast interview on Wednesday, Mr. Carr described Mr. Kimmel's remarks as part of a concerted effort to lie to the American people about the beliefs of Mr. Kirk's killer. He said the FCC was going to have remedies that we can look at. "Frankly, when you see stuff like this, I mean, we can do this the easy way or the hard way," Mr. Carr told podcast host Benny Johnson. "These companies can find ways to change conduct and take action, frankly, on Kimmel, or there's going to be additional work for the FCC ahead." The FCC did not immediately respond to requests for comments. Mr. Carr went on Sean Hannity's Fox News program on Wednesday night. "I'm very glad to see that America's broadcasters are standing up to serve the interests of their community," Mr. Carr said. "We don't just have this progressive foie de gras coming out from New York and Hollywood." Okay, next article. Behind castle walls, the rich and powerful celebrate Trump. The seating chart at the state dinner for President Trump was a cross-section of the rich and the powerful, hoping to get on his good side. As beggars' banquets go, this one was pretty rich. There they sat, side by side, some of the wealthiest, most influential, and best-connected people in the world, all together at one long table inside a nearly 1,000-year-old castle. The guest of honor was in the middle of the table, wearing white tie, looking happier than ever. He was being treated like a king, but by an actual king. The state dinner that King Charles III hosted for President Trump on Wednesday night at Windsor Castle seemed like a new apex for Mr. Trump, a glittering showcase of the powerful outdoing themselves to get or remain on the good side of a president whose second term has been marked by demonstrations of brute power. Those demonstrations have increasingly taken the form of retribution against perceived enemies at home and tattered allies abroad. "The bond between our two nations is indeed a remarkable one," said Charles. "In renewing our bond tonight, We do so with unshakable trust in our friendship and in our shared commitment to independence and liberty. The president seemed supremely pleased by the whole thing. He didn't look the least bit bothered when the king used his speech to gently prod about environmental issues and the need to support Ukraine. Mr. Trump got up and cooed. It's a singular privilege to be the first American president welcomed here. Other U.S. presidents have been welcomed at Windsor, including Mr. Trump in his first term, albeit not at a state dinner. Usually those dinners happen at Buckingham Palace in London, but this old pile is undergoing renovations. Britain's aim is clear. The royals were working in tandem with the British government, lavishing attention and honors on the president on Wednesday so that he might be more pliable in negotiations with America's oldest ally in his diplomatic meeting with the prime minister on Thursday. But what about the rest of the table? There were 160 people sitting in that banquet room, and 1,452 pieces of cutlery clanging and scraping in hands held by media barons, financiers, politicians, and tech moguls. Peppered in between the power players were members of Mr. Trump's cabinet and most senior White House aides. Excuse me. The seating chart for Wednesday's dinner ought to be kept inside the castle and studied another 1,000 years from now as a fascinating document about the history of the West. This wasn't a table of pop singers, movie stars, celebrities, or fashion figures whose company Mr. Trump has often sought. This was not about star power. It was about real power. Britain's Prime Minister Keir Starmer was seated beside the New York financier and chief executive of Blackstone, Stephen Schwarzman. Bank of America's chief executive, Brian Moynihan, sat on that side of the table. So did Silicon Valley's boy king of artificial intelligence, Sam Altman, who was put beside Kimi Badenoch, the leader of Britain's Conservative Party. Demis Hassabis was there. He runs DeepMind, the secretive London AI lab owned by Google. And so was Satya Nadella, the top dog at Microsoft, and also Mark Benioff, the Salesforce co-founder. Tim Cook, the head of Apple, was there too. Mr. Cook's presence in particular seemed notable. It was just a few weeks ago that he appeared in the Oval Office with cameras rolling to give a beaming Mr. Trump a piece of handmade Corning glass in a 24-karat gold stand. It was a trophy meant to showcase his company's investment in the U.S., but also to help patch up his relationship with Mr. Trump, who was irked when the Apple executive chose not to join his fellow tech titans in the Middle East last May for the president's visit to the region. Mr. Trump took notice of Mr. Cook's absence and publicly poked at him during two stops on the trip. And so, there was Mr. Cook on Wednesday, seated beside Tiffany Trump in the banquet hall. Other than the First Lady, Melania Trump, who sat between Queen Camilla and Prince William, Tiffany and her husband were the only Trump relatives in attendance. But there was a dinner guest on Wednesday whose presence seemed especially telling. Across the table from Mr. Cook and a few places to the right sat media mogul Rupert Murdoch. He and Mr. Trump have a long and tangled on-again, off-again relationship. Things are definitely in the off mode at the moment. A few months ago, the Wall Street Journal, the crown jewel of Mr. Murdoch's newspaper empire, broke a story about Mr. Trump's former relationship with the deceased sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, leading the president to deny the story and sue the paper and its owner. Mr. Trump's suit became especially personal. He demanded successfully that the 94-year-old Murdoch provide updates about his health after the president pushed for him to be deposed within a matter of days. Mr. Murdoch's position in the banquet hall was far enough down the table that he was out of the president's field of vision, and yet he was still there, sitting through a speech about Mr. Trump's greatness. Intriguingly, the newspaper baron was seated beside Morgan McSweeney, the prime minister's chief of staff and right-hand man, who is currently taking a ton of heat in the media, most especially in the pages of, you guessed it, the Murdoch papers. Even on this night of maximum acquaintances, Mr. Trump's appetite for retribution was not sated. After the dinner was over, he posted gleefully on Trump on social media about how ABC had pulled the comedian and Trump critic Jimmy Kimmel's show off the air indefinitely. He also posted that he was designating the Antifa movement as a major terrorist organization. He did this all while he was preparing to spend the night inside the castle. Windsor Castle is often described as the oldest and largest inhabited castle in the world, in almost continuously use since William I built it up in the aftermath of the Norman conquest in 1066. There's a moat and thick stone walls and a maze of rooms. The soaring banquet hall contains the shields of the Knights of the Garter dating back to 1348. Polished suits of armor look down on the dining table from pleats carved into the walls. Outside those castle gates, Mr. Trump must return to a world that does not necessarily see him, or at least will not necessarily treat him, the way that the mighty men and women gathered at Windsor Castle did. Last week, when the president left the White House to have his first dinner out in Washington since his comeback, he got screamed at inside a restaurant by a band of protesters who, while supporting Gaza, compared him to Adolf Hitler. They were tossed out. Still, in Britain, the night before the state dinner, protesters beamed images of Mr. Trump socializing with Mr. Epstein onto the walls of the castle, a reminder of the political furor that awaits him back home. After all, fortresses are designed to keep the world out, and no banquet lasts forever. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Okay, next article. NVIDIA to buy $5 billion stake in Intel, giving rival a lifeline. The deal between the chipmakers, whose fortunes have diverged sharply, includes plans to collaborate on technology to power artificial intelligence. NVIDIA, the world's dominant maker of artificial intelligence chips, said on Thursday that it would invest $5 billion in its struggling rival, Intel, a deal that illustrates how booming demand for AI is reshaping the global technology industry. The deal is a lifeline for Intel and highlights a reversal of fortune between the two Silicon Valley companies. Once an industry leader, Intel has struggled to keep up with technology shifts to mobile devices and AI. Last month, the Trump administration agreed to buy a roughly 10% stake in the company to bolster its shaky financial position. NVIDIA, by contrast, is one of the world's biggest and most geopolitically significant companies, producing the key chips needed for developing AI. Jensen Huang, the company's chief executive, has become an industry superstar and joined President Trump in Britain this week for a state dinner at Windsor Castle. Intel's shares soared more than 25% in pre-market trading. NVIDIA's stock rose about 3%. The partnership between the two American chipmakers comes as China tries to become less dependent on U.S. chip technology and manufacture more semiconductors domestically. On Thursday, the Chinese technology giant Huawei said it was expanding AI chip development, a move that would challenge NVIDIA. As part of their deal, NVIDIA and Intel said they would collaborate in developing chips for personal computers and data centers. Intel specializes in chips known as central processing units that serve as the brain of a computer by coordinating different tasks across a machine. NVIDIA makes other chips known as graphics processing units that are powerful for narrower tasks like crunching vast amounts of data. The companies said that they would develop chips for personal computers and data centers that incorporate both strengths, which could appeal to companies that need huge amounts of computing power for data centers and research. Together, we will expand our ecosystems and lay the foundation for the next era of computing, Mr. Huang said in a statement. NVIDIA, which has market value of more than $4 trillion, said it would buy about $5 billion of Intel's common stock, a stake worth about 4% of the smaller company. It would pay $23.28 per share, a discount from Intel's closing price on Wednesday. Based on today's stock gains, NVIDIA has already profited from the deal. We appreciate the confidence Jensen and the NVIDIA team have placed in us with their investment and look forward to the work ahead as we innovate for customers and grow our business. Lip Bhutan, the chief executive of Intel, said in a statement. NVIDIA and Intel have headquarters about 2 miles apart on an expressway in Santa Clara, California, but their paths have diverged in recent years. Intel was long one of Silicon Valley's most powerful and consequential companies. The company designed and manufactured the semiconductors that powered machines running Microsoft Windows that helped popularize personal computers. The company lived by the maxim of a long-serving chief executive, Andy Grove: only the paranoid survive. But over the past two decades, Intel lost its way, cycling through chief executives and corporate strategies while laying off thousands of employees. It missed the smartphone revolution after Apple's introduction of the iPhone in 2007, and it has struggled to capitalize on demand for AI applications. NVIDIA has prospered, once a niche developer of chips used for video game consoles. The company is now at the center of the AI boom. Its chips are packed into data centers by the thousands and power chatbots and other AI applications for companies, including OpenAI, Google, and Microsoft. Okay, staying in the tech industry, here's the next article. Meta unveils smart glasses with apps and an artificial intelligence assistant. At its annual developer conference on Wednesday, Meta showed several new smart glasses, which have been a surprise hit for the company. 4 years ago, when Meta released smart glasses that could take photos and videos, the product became a surprise hit. Since then, millions have snapped them up. Now the company is raising its bets on eyewear. On Wednesday, at its annual developer conference in Menlo Park, California, Meta unveiled three new types of smart glasses. One of them, called Meta Ray-Ban Display, has a tiny screen in its lenses that can display apps, share media to Instagram and play music from built-in speakers. The apps on the glasses will be controlled by a wristband. It also has a voice-based artificial intelligence assistant that can talk through a speaker and see through a camera. Another pair was an upgraded version of its existing Ray-Bans, while the third was meant for sportswear and is being made by Oakley. Meta Ray-Ban display will cost $799, about double the price of older versions, and will be released on September 30th. At the conference, some of Meta's smart glasses appeared unfinished. On stage for the unveiling on Wednesday evening, Mark Zuckerberg, the company's chief executive, asked the glasses to provide a barbecue sauce recipe and to call a colleague, but the devices failed to do so. "They tell us not to do live demos," Mr. Zuckerberg said, while the audience laughed along. He added that the glasses will be able to see what you see, hear what you hear, and then go off and think about it. Meta has billed its smart glasses and virtual reality headsets as a way to experience the metaverse, a virtual world that Mr. Zuckerberg has called the future of the internet. But this year, the glasses were aimed more at everyday uses, reading text while on a walk, for instance, or a way to get directions to the grocery store. The smart glasses are an extension of Meta's work on artificial intelligence. The company has been pumping billions of dollars into building new data centers and revamping its AI division, which is focused on creating super intelligence. A hypothetical form of AI that could be more powerful than the human brain. On Wednesday, Mr. Zuckerberg called glasses the ideal form of super intelligence. Unlike the company's heavier virtual reality headsets, Meta's smart glasses resemble regular eyeglasses. The cameras, microphones, and speakers are barely visible, which gives them a broader appeal than the bulkier devices, said Melissa Otto, the head of research and S&P Global Visible Alpha. The metaverse was geared very much toward gamers, Ms. Otto said. But think about how many people wear sunglasses. Okay, next article from the opinion section, an article by Jessica Gross. The unexpected upside of phone bans in schools. The Jefferson County Public Schools in Kentucky this month announced a surprising unintended consequence of a new statewide cell phone ban. In many of the district schools, the number of books checked out in the first few weeks of class had skyrocketed compared with last year, before the ban was instituted. In just the first 17 days of the school year at Pleasure Ridge Park High School in Louisville, where only 17% of the students are proficient in reading, according to state assessments, the district said that students have checked out more than 1,200 books, nearly half the total number borrowed during the entire 2024-25 school year. At other schools in the district, Kentucky's largest, the results are even more impressive. 40% of students at one high school have checked books out of the library, doubled the number who borrowed books all last year. I discovered that this heartening news the same day as I read this headline. Reading skills of 12th graders hit a new low. Results from the National Assessment of Educational Progress, or NAEP, considered the global standard of educational assessments, showed that about a third of the 12th graders who were tested last year did not have basic reading skills, according to many newsroom colleague Dana Goldstein. Some of these students have comprehension levels so low they may not be able to decipher the meaning of a political speech, Goldstein notes. The picture for low-performing 12th graders is sad. Tim Daly, chief executive of Ed Navigator and the author of a newsletter on education, told me in an email, "We have way more kids now who are fundamentally illiterate. They're going to struggle as adults with things like identifying a location on a map, knowing how or where to report for jury duty, and following instructions to fast before a medical test. Basic, everyday stuff." While many factors play into the decline in test scores over the past decade, this is more evidence that the ubiquity of smartphones in our school is part of it. Sometimes the obvious answer is also the right answer. I called Leslie Muldoon, the executive director of the National Assessment Governing Board, which sets policies for and analyzes the NAEP, to ask about the most recent results. She told me that looking at the results over time, the pivotal year really looks to be 2013. That was some stagnation. There was some stagnation in test scores before that. But once you get to that 2013, you start to see steady decline in math and reading. That long predates COVID school closures, which is what so many public officials point to as the moment when school performance fell off the cliff. The time frame over a decade ago jives with other statistics about teenagers' internet use. The share of teens who report being online almost constantly has roughly doubled since 2014 and 2015. 24% then versus 46% today, according to a Pew Research fact sheet published in July. Correlation is not causation, but there have been studies showing that devices in classrooms aren't distracting just from their users. Their peers in proximity are also distracted and may do worse on tests. The omnipresence of devices, including school-provided laptops, affects even the best students' attention spans. And basically every college-level instructor I have interviewed in the past decade has told me that his or her students no longer have the patience for analyzing longer texts. By this point, we've all heard about the elite college student who can't read books. But when you drill down into the 12th grade NAEP reading scores, the top 25% are doing about as well as they have since the 1990s. The story here is that the bottom 25% have fallen more precipitously. Muldoon pointed out to me that while the children of college-educated parents tend to do better on the NAEP overall, a good chunk of the lowest performers also have college-educated parents. Nearly 40% of lower performers had parents who graduated from college, and over 40% were from the middle socioeconomic stratum, showing that the declines in reading abilities cut across demographic lines. This should alarm policymakers. It seems that few demographic groups aren't touched by this. This school year does feel like a turning point in terms of a bipartisan, widespread acknowledgement that screens in schools, not just cell phones, were a natural experiment that went completely off the rails. 34 states and the District of Columbia have signed or already enacted policies restricting cell phone use in K-12 schools. Beyond cell phone bans, there are other ways school districts are addressing their students. Woeful literacy. Tim Daly pointed out Richmond, Virginia as a bright spot. Some of its schools added 20 days of instruction to help close COVID literacy gaps. And they've seen considerable increase in their early elementary literacy scores. Virginia also has a cell phone ban in place, but it went into effect only this year. so it's too soon to tell if it will also help improve literacy. To reach older children who have slipped through the cracks, middle and high school teachers may need better training, or schools may have to employ more remedial literacy experts. Parents also need to be better informed about how their students are doing. Some of this is better communication between parents and students, but it is also about the kind of standards teachers hold for their students. There is rampant grade inflation, and state test scores don't tend to come out until the school year is over, so parents may discover too late that their children's skills are below grade level. I interviewed a Georgia middle school teacher in 2023 who went viral for talking about how his seventh grade students were still reading at a fourth grade level. And he told me that no matter how many zeros he puts in the grade book, his students will be passed along to eighth grade. In an opinion essay this month in the Wall Street Journal, Roland Fryer, a professor of economics at Harvard, succinctly described what schools need to do to improve learning. Institute more instruction time, high expectations, frequent teacher feedback, data-driven instruction, and high dosage tutoring. While this prescription is straightforward, it's not easy and it's not cheap. Schools need the money, the will, and the time to do it. In the meantime, cell phone bans, it turns out that when kids aren't allowed to doom scroll, take rude pictures of each other, or rot their brains on TikTok during lunch hour or in study hall, they get bored enough to go to the library and check out books. If there are 8 full hours, 5 days a week, during which students can't look at their phones, they may also discover that they enjoy reading for pleasure, a pastime that too many teenagers have abandoned. Despite some parents grumbling about the new bans, I see very little downside and a lot of positive, unintended benefits. All right, next article. Kennedy's vaccine committee to vote on hepatitis B and COVID shots. The advisory committee, which will meet on Thursday and Friday, is expected to recommend limiting use of some vaccines, including the hepatitis B shot for newborns. An influential federal committee that recommends vaccine policies for Americans is set to meet on Thursday and Friday to review important immunizations that have long been used. The panel, called the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, is expected to vote on the shots for COVID and hepatitis B, a highly infectious disease that damages the liver, as well as on a combination vaccine called MMRV, which offers protection against measles, mumps, rubella, and chickenpox. Health Secretary Robert Kennedy Jr. has frequently questioned the safety of these vaccines. On Wednesday, Susan Menares, who was ousted from the Center of Disease Control and Prevention after less than a month as its director, told lawmakers that Mr. Kennedy planned to revise the childhood immunization schedule. He directed me to commit in advance to approving every ACIP recommendation regardless of the scientific evidence, she said. On Thursday, the committee is expected to limit the use of the hepatitis B vaccine, recommended that it be given only to newborns whose mothers are known to be infected with the virus. The panel may also rescind use of the MMRV vaccine. On Friday, it may vote to narrow the recommendations for who should receive the COVID vaccine. The committee's votes may not have as much influence as in the past. Insurance companies are required to cover all vaccines endorsed by the committee, although they may choose to cover more. But on Wednesday, AHIP, the National Trade Association representing the health insurance industry, said health plans would continue to cover all immunizations that have been recommended as of September 1st, including updated formulations of the COVID and flu vaccines at no cost for patients through 2026. The evidence-based approach to coverage of immunizations will remain consistent, the association said in a statement. Still, the committee's votes this week may serve as a harbinger of wide-ranging changes to the childhood immunization schedule. Mr. Kennedy appointed all 12 current members of the committee after firing the 17 previous members en masse in June. Seven of the new members were appointed to the panel later that month. The other five were announced on Monday. While the seven panelists met in June, they announced that they would scrutinize all the vaccinations recommended for children and adolescents. They also voted to rescind a longstanding recommendation for a small subset of flu shots that contain a preservative called thimerosal, which many anti-vaccine groups have falsely said causes autism. In an interview this month, Dr. Robert Malone, one of the panelists, said the mission of the committee was to revisit the entire pediatric schedule, insisting on data for vaccine-to-vaccine interactions. Mr. Kennedy has repeatedly said he believes that the number of shots children get now is unsafe, but experts have said the idea that today's vaccine are overtaxing children's immune systems is fundamentally flawed. Dr. Malone has previously said on X that he considers the label anti-vaxxer to be high praise. The committee will also weigh in on the appropriateness of immediate afterbirth vaccination with hepatitis B vaccines, Mr. Malone added. He was referring to the first dose of the hepatitis B vaccine, which is given to newborns within 24 hours of birth. The shot is credited by public health experts with nearly eliminating maternal transmissions of the disease in the United States, slashing the incidence to fewer than 20 cases a year from about 20,000 a year before 1991. Dr. Richard Besser, the chief executive of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and a former acting director at the CDC, said that if the panel limited hepatitis B shots for babies, which seems likely, it might lead to a resurgence of the disease among children. Each meeting takes us closer to a time where vaccine-preventable diseases become a norm in our society, he said of the panel. Untreated hepatitis B can damage the liver, leading to cirrhosis, liver failure, and liver cancer. More than 9% of infants infected with the virus develop chronic, lifelong hepatitis B. Mr. Kennedy and his allies have urged that hepatitis B is transmitted only through sexual contact or sharing needles, and therefore only babies of infected women should be immunized at birth. But the highly contagious virus can also be spread in other ways, including by household objects that are used by an infected person, like toothbrushes, razors, or combs, said Dr. James Campbell, the vice chair of the Infectious Disease Committee for the American Academy of Pediatrics. We've had, in the past, risk-based hepatitis B vaccination recommendations, and they did not reduce the overall burden, he said, referring to vaccinating only a birth when a mother is infected. That's why we have universal recommendations now. Excuse me. The vote on hepatitis B is scheduled for Thursday. The panelists will also vote on the MMRV shot, which has been available since 2005. Martin Kulldorff, the panel's chair, presented data in June showing that the combination vaccine slightly increases the risk of seizures caused by a fever, which can occur with any childhood illness, but do not cause lasting harm. But not all children receive the MMRV combination vaccine. The CDC already recommends administering the shot for MMR and the chickenpox separately, especially the first dose, which is given to children under 2 because of the risk of seizures. A separate vote on COVID vaccines is scheduled for Friday. You are listening to our reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Okay, next article. Syria's president says border deal with Israel could come within days. Syrian and Israeli officials have been holding talks about security arrangements along their shared border as part of U.S.-mediated efforts to reset decades of hostility. President Ahmad al-Shara of Syria has said that his country is negotiating a potential agreement with Israel aimed at decreasing tensions along their shared border, and an accord could be reached within days. Syria and Israel have officially been enemies for decades, but since the rebels he led toppled the dictator Bashar al-Assad in December of last year, Mr. al-Shara has pursued a more conciliatory approach, citing self-defense concerns. Israel has occupied territory in southern Syria and carried out hundreds of airstrikes inside the country, including near the presidential palace where Mr. al-Shara works. With U.S. mediation, officials from his government have been talking to the Israelis for months about a possible security agreement for southern Syria. Mr. al-Shara, speaking to researchers and reporters in the capital of Damascus late on Wednesday, said Syria is tired of conflict after more than 13 years of civil war and was working to ensure peace with its neighbors. "We could reach an agreement at any moment," he said of the talks with Israel, but the challenge, he said, would be whether Israel would stick to it. Syria's economy and military were both largely destroyed during the civil war, giving the country limited leverage in the talks, analysts say. Israeli officials have said they intend to keep forces in Syria to prevent any hostile forces from entrenching near its borders. Israel also want southern Syria to remain free of Syrian government troops. It remains unclear what exactly the sides are seeking in the current talks. The office of Israel's Minister of Strategic Affairs, Ron Dermer, who has been leading the talks with Syria officials, did not immediately respond to requests for comment. Israel and Syria have been officially at war since 1948, with their most enduring points of contention being the Golan Heights, a strategic plateau that Israel captured in the 1967 Middle East War and later annexed. The two countries signed an agreement in 1974 that established a UN-patrolled buffer zone between their forces, and the border has been largely quiet for decades. With Mr. al-Assad's ouster, Israeli officials said they considered the accord void until order was restored in Syria. Mr. al-Shara said on Wednesday that his government has continued to abide by the 1974 armistice agreement despite Israelis' repeated violations of it. He said that the aim of the current talks is to reach new border arrangements similar to the 1974 agreement, including a buffer zone and monitoring by international forces. Mr. al-Shara said the status of Mount Hermon and the Golan Heights, disputed territories that Israel now controls is not part of the current talks. Okay, now probably last article for today. The Twilight Zone gave a glimpse of Robert Redford's gifts. In a memorable 1962 episode of The Twilight Zone, the actor, still in his early 20s, played the most charming emissary of the afterlife imaginable. Long before Robert Redford played Bob Woodward, Jay Gatsby, Jeremiah Johnston, or the Sundance Kid, he was Death in a memorable 1962 episode of The Twilight Zone, often cited as one of the anthology's best. The blonde, handsome actor, still in his early 20s, played the most charming, calming emissary of the afterlife imaginable, assigned to escort a wary old lady into the great beyond. That episode, titled Nothing in the Dark, streaming on Paramount Plus, was also the beginning of the end of Redford's brief but prolific TV career. Watching him now as Mr. Death, it's easy to see how he became one of the most beloved movie stars of the late 20th century. His presence is uncanny. His looks like he looks like he belongs somewhere else, on a bigger screen perhaps. We hear Redford before we see him in Nothing in the Dark as the episode opens. The lady, Wanda Dunn, with Gladys Cooper, is cowering in the basement apartment of a tenant building, avoiding any visitors because she knows her date with Death is past due. Then she hears a gunshot, and a young, non-threatening voice from outside asks for help. She opens the door a crack and sees a policeman on his back in the snow. Our first glimpse of Redford as the policeman is the same as Wanda's. He looks small and helpless. He also seems, well, nice, sunny, even. The very opposite of doom. Nothing in the Dark was written by the frequent Twilight Zone contributor George Clayton Johnson, whose work on the show was highly compatible with the vision of its creator, Rod Serling, who liked to tell stories about frightened, ordinary people confronting their own weaknesses. Death appears as a person in multiple Twilight Zone episodes. To that end, another series regular, the director, Lamont Johnson, no relation to George, goes deep into Wanda's mind by exploring the cluttered, shadowy space where she has dwelled for too long, avoiding the light. And then, here's this very pleasant cop flashing a disarming smile after she lets him in to rest and recuperate. He asks her questions, coaxing her into explaining a life of cowardice. By the time Wanda realizes Officer Belden is the very Mr. Death she has been trying to dodge, she finally understands why she has to go. Like his occasional big screen co-stars, Paul Newman and Jane Fonda, Redford spent much of his early career making do with the more shallow, predictable parts Hollywood had to offer to attractive young actors at the time. It was as though he and his peers were waiting patiently for the artistic freedom of the late 60s and 70s. In those fledgling years, Redford honed his tools as a performer. His stillness, his penetrating gaze, his sly smile, and his deep, deliberate speaking voice. Redford accepted a lot of television guest star roles in the early 60s, at a time when TV drew plenty of talent from the New York theater scene. Watch enough of retro channels like MeTV or Grit, and you will see Redford pop up in Perry Mason, The Virginian, or Alfred Hitchcock Presents. He is also arresting, and not just because his face is so familiar. In The Twilight Zone, companion, a guide to the show, the writer Mark Scott Zicree pans Redford, saying he performs with all the emotion of a male mannequin, which he strongly resembles. This was a criticism Redford sometimes faced even in his movie star days, partly because of his rugged good looks, and more so because of his preference for underplaying. Redford was never a shouter or a scenery chewer. But that's what makes his performance on The Twilight Zone work so beautifully. Once Wanda lets Mr. Death in, he seems relaxed and reassuring. He seems inevitable. The episode's big twist comes after the introduction of its third character, an aggressive man, R.G. Armstrong, who barges in and seems like everything Wanda dreads. This man turns out to be a building contractor there to warn her that her home is about to be demolished. He, too, is reassuring in his way, explaining that sometimes society has to tear down the old to make way for the new. Times change and generations shift. Why, even death looks young and spry nowadays. By the time Redford appeared in The Twilight Zone, he had a couple of minor movies on his resume and had been in over a dozen TV episodes and teleplays, including the final Playhouse 90 broadcast. The Searling penned, "In the presence of mine enemies," buoyed his star turn in Neil Simon's 1963 Broadway hit, Barefoot in the Park. Redford moved into movies, and his time as a serial TV guest star was over. But it's still exciting to see Redford in one of those old shows, like The Twilight Zone. It's like finding a rare gem in a thrift store. First he catches the eye, and then he holds it. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the September 18th issue of the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Your reader today has been Mark Ryer. Thank you for listening.